mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome, everybody. As always, have a great show for you this week. Before we begin, I wanted to draw your attention to something pretty interesting. Optimal Blue just completed basically an ROI study. The key findings of that study, they're out right now. You can check them out on our website, but more good stuff to come from that report. The objectives of the study were to quantify real economic value of using Optimal Blue products, basically. So demonstrable ecosystem level impact on your mortgage operations. So essentially an operational and financial impact study. So yeah, go check it out. It was done by a third party. I think they just did a really nice job with it. Okay. Getting back to it, in the interest of making sure you know what to watch, whether you're an originator, a capital markets person, or just someone interested in the mortgage industry and some great market commentary, we're going to get into a couple of subjects today. We're going to talk market, of course, with James and Alex. And then after that, Alex and I are going to chat a little bit with you all about this kind of credit reporting saga that is taking place right now. So if you've heard people talk about FICO 10T, you've heard people talk about Vantage Score, you've heard Bill Pulte, for instance, tweet about the ability to use some of these new models, especially Vantage Score, for scoring, qualifying, pricing mortgages. So Alex and I will talk about that here in a little bit. Before we get to any of that, just in the way of data, as you know, since the beginning of the Iran war, rates are up, unfortunately, and spreads have widened as well. So the 10-year is down a little bit at 4.33 compared to last week, but the OBMMI is still right around 6.5%, so higher than we've seen it in many months. And again, the war has a lot to do with that, inflation expectations, that sort of thing. We'll talk about all that in a moment. And spreads are widening between the 10-year and the mortgage, unfortunately. And that has pushed volume down. So let's talk with Alex and James here in a moment and see what's going on in the market. All right. Welcome, gentlemen. Hey, Alex. Hey, James. Thanks for being here to talk today.
Yeah, good morning.
Okay. Where to begin? We are 30 days into the war with Iran. Not a ton in the way of developments in the actual war, other than more organizations getting involved. As you might expect with this sort of conflict, you start having pods or cells of other organizations starting to, I don't know, create their own problems in some of their either enemy countries, or they're attacking us in other countries, right? Our interests and our bases. But anyway, 30 days in, I mean, where do you see it? Where do you see it this week? I mean, that's what's dominating the headlines, therefore what's dominating the market, right?
Yeah, it's we can keep this, you know, somewhat short, but in regards to week over week changes in this conflict, there hasn't been a ton. You know, there's little flirts of peace deals being offered out on social media. That I've yet to see anything that looks really substantive on that, although I think we won't know until it's just about finalized. And then in regards to the conflict itself, it's continued kind of a pace, seen some slight expansions there. The Houthis in Yemen, who are Iran-linked group, they've begun launching their own drones and missiles. There's some militias in Iraq doing the same towards U.S. bases in Israel. And then there's a concurrent operation that Israel is launched against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. So, you know, all these things just continuing same as they were last week. I think, you know, as someone based in the U.S., you know, what to keep an eye on here is really that price of oil. It's going to continue to, you know, melt up the longer the strait remains closed. As we covered last week, the U.S. Has better insulation against this strait closure than Asia and Europe does, but it's going to have global impacts, and those impacts are going to grow by the day as the conflict continues.
Nut oil price, you know, as of recording, it's sitting at about $113 a barrel. This is really the highest we've been. Looking into it, stuff like this always makes me laugh, that it's the highest ever been since 2022, which is not that long ago, but that was when Russia-Ukraine broke out. And then if you want to see a level about that high prior to that date, it's 2008, you know, a spat in 2011. But, you know, it's all of a sudden it becomes a decade since we've seen this. It just, the last 5 years has been such a rush. But that $113 per barrel, it's really pricey. That is not really a long-term sustainable price that we want to be seeing.
Yeah, as we've talked about, it's, you know, it's up 30, 40, 50% oil, and that translates to obviously higher prices at the pump, but also higher prices for everything over time, right? Transportation of goods, expensive services. So it's changed expectations significantly in terms of where interest rates may be later on this year. In fact, you know, rate cuts seem off the table at this point. Certainly that's how you would read the CME futures and just listening to what the Fed is saying recently. In fact, it looks like there's a better chance of a hike than a cut at this point. There's almost no chance of cuts later on this year, but there is, maybe call it even, like there's just as much of a chance of a hike as a cut if you go out into like second half of this year, which is a far cry from where we were before this war started.
Absolutely. The CME Fed Watch, it's flat all the way out through mid, if not late 2027 at this point. I think we're going to get greater direction on that, you know, once the fighting itself actually stops. I think everyone's really in a holding pattern to see how long this damage to energy markets is going to last. I hear the same thing you do, Jeb, of there's whispers out there of, you know, if inflation really does take off, that rate hikes could be necessitated by that.
At the beginning of all this, we said it was, you know, there's a 4 to 6 week timeline before energy shock should actually start more so showing up, just because of how much the length of time it takes to turn these pumping facilities back on to get oil back through. And so here we are at week four, bleeding into week five. That puts us at, you know, is it going to end in the next 24 hours, 48 hours before we should see some of this bleeding through? That's really what's pushing. There might be more price shocks coming. There might be inflation. Maybe we're going to see a rate hike with everything. You know, we haven't really gotten the rates or unemployment or inflation exactly to where we want it to be. So it's a little bit sketchier now. We might see a rate hike is why that's starting to pop up.
Right. Meanwhile, long-term rates up about half a point since the war started, as we've said, right? So you get OBMMI is about 6.5%. 10 years, about 4.5%. So between the inflation expectations and even just, you know, the extra $200 billion that the president wants to spend on this war, like all of these things are adding to what would be a supply of debt, which, as we know, will cause yields to go higher so that those yields will attract investors. Okay, so what about the microcosm of this short Easter week? As y'all may or may not know, it's kind of like a 4.25 day week this week. So Friday is, the market is open on Good Friday, but only open for, bond markets are only open for 4 hours, right? It's kind of a half day, noon close Eastern time on Friday, partially because there will be a jobs announcement. There will be an unemployment report that comes out at the usual time on Friday. And that's another thing to keep an eye on, because the jobs market is obviously the other half of the Fed's mandate. Last month, so the February jobs report that came out in the first week of March was the first to show a negative non-farm payrolls number. So this time around, are we expecting something in that range, or something small, something close to zero?
The expectations in the positive range, but it's in the range that we would have expected out of a pre-COVID non-farm number. It's expected around 45,000 this time around. As you said, Jim, it was sharply negative, close to negative 90,000 last time around. There were some labor strikes in there that kind of muddied the water on that those jobs will come back on this report. But even without those, it still would have been a negative release. With the conflict in Iran, this has kind of gone by the wayside, but the labor market was what we were concerned about, you know, in February and January, and if there were cracks there and, you know, if they were beginning to show, and how long those disruptions from AI could be, you know, that's what we talked about the whole back half of last year as we saw inflation taper off into 2 point something. So this could be a sneaky, impactful labor report, in my opinion, just because it's going to bring back some of those domestic questions that we've kind of stopped asking as we all read the headlines day after day.
Sure.
Yeah, as you know, we've all been talking again about inflation, maybe a rate hike, right? Looking at those numbers, with the report coming out this week, the unemployment rate is probably going to go from 4.4 to about 4.5%. So creeping up, definitely the wrong direction for this. It's still not any sort of critical level, but as long as it keeps moving in the wrong direction and inflation potentially moving in the wrong direction, that's stagflationary. We definitely don't want to see that.
Right. That 4.5 sort of psychological barrier seems to be where the Fed really starts to pay attention, right? Like you said, it's not critical at 4.5, but if we keep moving a tenth of a point in that direction each month, you could see that the Fed being compelled to make a move if we get closer to anything close to 5%. I think 4.6, 4.7, we're really in a market that is shrinking at that point, an economy that's shrinking, or that at the very least it's stagnant. Which is not, you know, not what the Fed wants to see, and certainly not what the administration wants to see. All right. What else are we looking forward to this week, gentlemen?
I have the ADP jobs report coming out as well. So just a little bit more jobs information a little earlier. They tend to be a little more volatile than the actual numbers. But in this past year, they were predicting negative shocks before the official numbers did. So it's a good look at, hey, these are some maybe worst case scenarios.
Right. Right. Yeah, that number has been increasingly relied upon, I think, especially with some of the, I don't know, disbelief with some of the numbers that come out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Certainly the White House had some issues with those numbers earlier on in the current administration, to the point where they replaced, you know, some of the high ranking members of that bureau, and who knows if they've actually made significant improvements there where they felt like it was lacking.
Yeah, and with the government shutdowns that have happened this year, it's just become slower to get the government reports.
Okay, great. So not a super busy week in terms of numbers, but some big ones. So we'll see the big unemployment report on Friday. Likely some news about the war this week as well. Hopefully some good news about a possible de-escalation or even some sort of delay or stoppage in the fighting. And then we'll really find out what that means long-term for the market. All right. Good market update. Thank you, gentlemen, as always. Have a good day.
Same to
you. Thank you.
All right, Alex. Something I wanted to cover today. We covered it actually on a webinar mid last week, and we get a lot of questions on our trade desk about it. We're getting questions across Optimal Blue because this is basically, it's a growing issue out there on things like LinkedIn. So you hear a lot of chatter there and elsewhere. You can't go to a conference right now in our industry and not have a panel that is focused on changes that have come and are coming to credit reporting. So maybe not the most interesting subject on its face, but there actually is a lot of interesting stuff going on with credit reporting right now that's not super in the weeds even. It's kind of almost like an exercise or a lesson in economics, the way that it's playing out right now. So what we're talking about, you may have heard that there are changes that have come and are coming for credit reporting, especially for mortgages. So just the backdrop, in case you're not familiar, FICO score is what we would call it, right? FICO stands for Fair Isaac Corporation, that they've been kind of owning the credit reporting for mortgages for decades. So mortgages are priced, valued, your ability to repay is based on what they're now calling classic FICO, because there's these new models now. So we're calling it classic FICO, which is kind of old school, been around for decades. It's a tri-merge kind of situation, right? There's three credit bureaus that report on your credit, on any individual's credit. And you take those three scores, that FICO runs an analysis on what comes from these credit reporting agencies. And then you basically pick the middle. If you have three scores, you pick the middle of those scores, and that's your credit score for the purposes of getting a mortgage loan. So jump ahead, and this is where there's a bit of history that's been out there for quite a bit. Alex and I were just talking, right? This goes back to the credit crisis, right? The aftermath of the credit crisis. What happened there that kind of woke people up and said, maybe we should revolutionize or at least modernize or at least look into this credit scoring mechanism that we've been kind of just following without questioning it since I believe the early 80s.
As you said, in the wake of the global financial crisis, you know, politicians, those in Washington, D.C., really, you know, took a magnifying glass to everything in the mortgage industry. And credit reporting and FICO scores, credit scores themselves came under that microscope, as did everything else. And what came out of those investigations culminated in the 2017 Credit Score Competition Act. I know Tim Scott and another senator from Virginia co-sponsored it. And it was passed in 2017. And essentially what it did was it codified the ability for the FHFA to approve or deny alternatives to the classic FICO credit scoring model. And this has been a very slow roll. You know, they didn't get this act out until, you know, 9 years after the crisis itself. And, you know, here we are almost 10 years later, just beginning to see these new models begin to be adopted here in the mortgage industry. You were talking about the classic FICO. That's the one that you said has been around late 80s, early 90s. I know it was deployed. You know, if you've bought a house anytime in the last 30 years, that's what's been used to evaluate, you know, your creditworthiness, how big of a loan you can get. Since then, and since that 2017 act was passed, we've seen VantageScore be deployed. Now, this is another credit scoring model that is used on borrowers, and it was co-created by those three credit reporting bureaus that you talked about. Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion are the three. And their model was approved by the FHFA a couple years ago now to be used alongside classic FICO. So in theory, for a conforming loan, you could utilize either a classic FICO or the VantageScore. We've just seen a slow adoption of that VantageScore as it's taken a little bit more market share in that credit reporting space, where previously it was Fair Isaac or nothing.
Right. And it has caught on a little bit, but there's still some hurdles to jump over. So I think it's also worth noting that one of the reasons that a lot of folks in the industry, and then the current White House administration, has been fairly vocal about the adoption of VantageScore is pricing, right? A big thing was that FICO, because it was the only game in town, was able to raise their price over time. Some would say significantly, some would even say maybe more than was reasonable, to the point where it's not a major expense when originating a mortgage. It costs between $8,000 and $12,000 to originate a loan, and a credit report costs between, I believe it's like $80 and $200. But nonetheless, that's a price that's gone from $5 to $10 to $50 to $100 over time. So the current administration got a hold of that. You also have very vocal people on LinkedIn, other folks, activists in the industry, saying that something needs to be done about the cost, but also what we talked about earlier, just the fact that FICO has not been overhauled in many years. So like you said, enter VantageScore. VantageScore takes hold. A few hurdles there is, like, there's not a lot of guidance yet from the FHFA or Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac on what to do with that score. Like, how is it going to be used to qualify a borrower? And just as importantly, how is it going to be used to price that loan? Meaning, how do you use it to establish an interest rate? Because right now, you really only have classic FICO to use to price a loan. And because we have so much history of these credit scores, as you said, for the past 30 years, it's been used. Therefore, pretty much every mortgage that's out there right now was originally scored using FICO. Therefore, we know the delinquency rates and the payment performance of all of these trillions of dollars of mortgages just purely based on FICO score. So that's one chicken and an egg kind of thing that I think the industry is going to have to deal with for a while, is that there's this lack of history for VantageScore because it just hasn't been around that long. It hasn't been used, especially for GSE loans and government loans and this sort of thing. Although there's been a handful of, you know, FHA pools, for instance, that have used VantageScore. So you have this competition that's starting to brew. So you have VantageScore, you have Classic. So then FICO, though, also comes out with their own new version of credit scoring, right? So you have FICO 10T, they call it. And that, as I understand it, works similarly to VantageScore in a few ways. One, like it basically is meant to address some of the, maybe not deficiencies, but some of the things that could be better about FICO, you know, having been developed 30, 40 years ago. Obviously, there's better technology now. There's better data. There's some things that are lacking in a classic credit score that are going to, that are being addressed by VantageScore and FICO Score 10T, right? Some of those are trending, for instance. Like a FICO score is just kind of a snapshot in time, where VantageScore and FICO 10T look more at a person's credit over time. Are they trending worse in credit? You know, are they accumulating more debt? Are they missing payments over the past 6 to 18 months? Or are they getting better? Like that could be good for a borrower if their credit score is improving, but it's not quite to the, I don't know, prime levels yet. It will take that into account. So that's just a couple of things that are being addressed by these new credit scoring mechanisms. And I think the other one would be rent, right, Alex? Rent is, or other types of, they would call it thin credit. Some borrowers just don't have a ton of stuff on their credit report to evaluate them. So these new mechanisms bring in additional data that the current classic FICO score doesn't.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, there's two big changes to these new and improved credit models that improve upon that classic FICO. One, as you said, is that trended data. It's no longer a snapshot in time. It can show if you as a borrower have been improving or degrading in your borrowing habits and your ability to make payments on time. The other is that there's a recognition that the economy has changed, you know, in the last 30 years. And there's also, I think, a tacit admission that we want to, you know, expand, you know, the pool of people who are able to be scored and you know, achieve that American dream of owning a home. And so, like you said, they've opened the circle a bit of the items that make its way onto that report. As you said, rent is one of those items. So if you can show that you're a responsible renter, that you make your payments on time, you know, that goes a long way towards proving that you'd be able to, you know, make your housing payments when it comes to a mortgage as well. Utilities are on there as well. And then there's also some exclusions in some of the models. You know, there's the VantageScore one specifically excludes medical collections. Medical debt is a major source of debt for Americans. And, you know, they've made the decision on that particular model to, you know, exclude that.
Interesting. Yeah, that's always been kind of the exception to the rule, the medical bills, because at times, just with kind of how screwed up our healthcare system is, you can end up in unavoidable debt from a medical bill. And that's usually the one, if you can't afford it, that's the one you don't pay, right? You stay current on everything, your car, your house, your credit cards, but that's the one that was unexpected, I suppose, and could be huge. So a lot of folks will let those lapse, and sometimes rightfully so. It's, you know, because they're just, it's too large of a bill to pay. So it's interesting that they would exclude those, because it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a poor credit recipient. You know, it just means that you kind of got yourself in a tough situation for good reasons. Okay. So yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, what to think about if you're an originator, you likely already know about this saga. You're likely on LinkedIn, maybe even opining on this. You've seen the tweets from Bill Pulte, the chairman of the FHFA, coming out and saying, you know, VantageScore is eligible for GSE delivery immediately, right? That's what got, I think, this really in the public eye last year. Because again, politically speaking, there's a lot of motivation to back the Vantage Score becoming a major competitor to FICO for the pricing reason, for the quality, right? Just to create competition to force FICO and any other competitor that comes to just to create something that's better. So in that regard, I think it's a good thing. It's just, you know, when will we be able to actually price loans and use these new mechanisms in our day-to-day lives as mortgage originators, as borrowers, as capital markets people? We don't know the answer to that yet. It's, you know, the adoption's there for things like pre-qualification. We've heard a lot of clients use it to pre-qualify a loan for loans that are in their portfolio, potentially meaning a loan they did years ago that they own, if they want to continue pulling credit on that, partially because Vantage Score is less expensive, but also because it is a trended analysis, so they can kind of get a better view into what the how the borrower is performing. So the next step is just going to be the GSEs and investors. So investors meaning big banks that buy mortgage loans, having them publish pricing that's for Vantage Score and possibly for FICO 10T, so that those two models then can move forth. And eventually, I think the plan would be for FICO to eliminate or retire classic FICO, because they're also working on some even newer models than FICO 10T for other types of mortgage loans.
I'd agree with all those statements. I think we'll see here in the 5 to 10 year time span, we'll see a pretty healthy ecosystem of two coexisting FICO scores. But I do think right now, as you said, the big barriers are on the investor, the street side of you know, getting enough data to say to accurately be able to price those Vantage scores as they originate more and more of those.
Right. And I guess, you know, one thing I would note that has not been addressed by either of these new models that's always bugged me, even looking at my own credit or when I was on the origination side of the business, is if you've ever noticed, if you've ever had your credit pulled and you get three scores, they can be very different from one another, right? So whether you're Vantage or FICO 10T right now, they're still getting their credit scores from the credit reporting agencies, as you mentioned, the three different agencies. And somehow those three bureaus are supposed to have the same scoring model, generally speaking, but they don't always have the same data. Meaning you could have 10 trade lines. A trade line would be like a credit card, a mortgage, a car loan. You could have 10 trade lines with one reporter and then 7 with another and 12 with the third. And those are going to be at various points of maturity, and you have different balances on those. So you can have a credit score of 740, 760, and then like 720. And to me, that's frustrating. That feels like something that should be addressed at some point. If the data is just bad, then how is that model? That model's going to be, that model could be better. Let's put it that way. If the inputs were cleaned up. Anyway, I didn't want to rant about that, but I did want to mention it because it is kind of an important point that should be one of the things that I feel that should get addressed here at some point to really fine tune the quality of these reports. It's having all of the trade lines that are available in the reports. All right. So yeah, I mean, if you're curious, definitely go out and read more about this. Copilot will give you a good, you know, or whatever AI machine you use will give you a good view into this, because it is kind of everywhere. LinkedIn has some pretty good rants about it as well. But otherwise, just if you're in our industry, keep watching. I think later this year, I would expect the GSEs to make some sort of announcement about how to price these. But that's going to be a whole nother can of worms that we'll have to open and deal with, because it's still not clear if I'm an originator, if I have to pick a lane, like I'm a Vantage Score shop, or I'm a FICO 10T shop, or I'm a classic, or am I going to pull all three for every loan up front? You know, some folks are already doing that just to kind of test the waters. What does a Vantage Score look like versus classic? That doesn't address the cost issue. That would make it more expensive. But it could give you the opportunity to pull three different styles of credit and therefore pick the best one to give the borrower the best rate. That could be good for the borrower. In fact, with a rate that's lower, that could arguably more than make up the cost of what a credit report cost the borrower. So that, you know, maybe the argument is there that you pull all three and you find the highest one. Anyway, more to come. We really don't know a ton other than what we've just told you, and the internet won't tell you a whole lot more, but I do expect news on this. And when that news comes out, we'll certainly talk about it again on the podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah. The mortgage industry is kind of late to the party when it comes to these. You know, you see much wider adoption of the newer models throughout other credit spaces, whether it's auto lending or credit cards and such. So more to come for sure.
Yeah. I mean, they're clearly better. Right? It's clearly an improvement. It's just a big boat that we have to turn around in the mortgage industry. I think there's so many vintages of loans that were scored on classic FICO that they know what that performance looks like. Even if that's not the best way to score today, it was the only thing for the past 30 years. So that's the history. That's the historical data we have to work with. So just making that jump, making that transition to these newer models is going to be, has its nuances, especially for the largest credit industry in the world.
Absolutely. A lot of plumbing to be reworked.
Definitely. All right, Alex. Great discussion, man. Appreciate you. Talk again soon.
Appreciate you, Jim. Thank you.
Okay, let's wrap this thing up. Thanks so much, Alex. Thank you, James. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.